Boat Fishers is asking, why are boat engines not engineered as well as car engines? With just oil changes, Toyotas can go 100 to 150,000 miles easily, which would be about 4,000 to 6,000 boat hours. Could you imagine if boats could go that long without a single issue? Well, Boat Fishers, thank you for subscribing and commenting. And there's a lot of reasons why boat engines don't last as long as car engines. And the mileage to hours ratio never really works out. I know you can do the calculations, and I mean, it comes out similar to what you're saying here, but it's the environment and the way that we use a boat engine compared to a car engine. So you're rolling around a car that's only 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, 3,000 pounds with no drag. The only resistance that you have on a car is air, whereas a boat, you're running around pushing 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 pounds through water with a propeller and a lower unit using gear reduction. And your car engine is only going to run, like you go out on the highway and you're running 80 miles an hour, you might turn 2,500, 3,000 RPM. Whereas in your boat, in order to do 30, 40 miles an hour, you're pushing 4, 45, 5,000 RPM. And then anything above that, you're running 6,000 RPM. So there's a lot more stress on it. And then you are using raw water from whatever you're running in, being salt water or anything like that, through the engine, and then using that to cool the system. And then going above that with pushing all the weight and the lower unit, the prop and everything, you are also just slamming through the water. So as that boat goes through the water, every wave it's taking a hit. And so that engine is just constantly being abused, basically. And it's through all of this that they just don't last as long as the car engines. I mean, they're abused, and the life is a lot harder. I mean, there are outboards out there that have 10,000 hours on them, but by and large, the general recreational person is only going to get 20 years and 3,000-4,000 hours out of their outboard, depending on how they use it. Obviously, if you take care of it, you can get way more than that. I mean, people running 40-year-old engines all day long. So it goes back to the care and the maintenance, but it's that RPM and the abuse and the waves and the water and the environment that the engine has to perform and live in is what makes it so hard for this piece of metal to last as long as like the Toyota Corolla, which, you know, Toyota Corolla is going to run for 500,000 miles with no problems. But other than that, that's kind of like the gist of it. I wish there was, you know, something better, but that's just kind of what it is. Alex says, good afternoon. I have a question. I have two OX66 250s and one is dumping raw fuel out of the exhaust. Can you assist? Thanks for your videos. Alex, there is a whole lot going on here. Without looking at the engine, you know, you've got a lot of different things. So in order to kind of talk about it, if you've got raw fuel coming out of an engine, that is because it's unburned. So either one, there's way too much fuel getting into the cylinder, and then that is just not being burned. Two, you're not getting spark. Your spark plugs are not firing, so the fuel is not getting ignited. Or three, you're not getting any air into the cylinder, and therefore you don't have combustion. Raw fuel is going to come out. So from the beginning, I would be checking the fuel pumps, the low pressure fuel pumps. There's three of them. They have diaphragms on the back of them. If there is a problem with those fuel pumps, it will leak fuel into the crankcase. And that will, one, it won't supply enough fuel to your VST to keep the engine running. So you'll probably bog down around 1,500, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 RPM, you know, some mid-range, you're going to bog down because you're going to run out of fuel, and it's going to run pretty horrible. You're going to foul plugs quite often. And then after that, there's going to be the VST. So in your VST, if the float is messed up, if the needle valve is messed up, if the float level is not correct, you could be filling the VST. It goes out of a vent because it's a vapor separator tank, and that vent then goes over to your intake, and it will dump that fuel in the intake, which will then just feed it to the engine. The engine's not going to be able to burn it, and it's going to just dump right out the exhaust. Now, there is also an O2 sensor on a OX66. So if there is a problem with the O2 sensor, it will tell the computer whether it's running rich or lean. If it tells the computer that it's running lean, then the computer is going to try and feed more fuel to the engine to richen it up. So if you have an O2 sensor problem, that could cause raw fuel to come out the exhaust. If you have an injector problem, so let's say the injector is stuck open, mechanically just stuck open, gets debris or something in there and it won't close, that will just dump fuel into a cylinder and come out. A lot of times it's not enough to notice it out the exhaust. If you're noticing it out of the exhaust, a lot of times it is something else because there's enough fuel to fill each one of the cylinders. If it's just one cylinder, you're not going to see it as heavily. So there is that caveat. A bad spark plug is the same thing as an injector. If it's not sparking, it's not burning the fuel, and then it's just dumping the fuel out the exhaust. Now, there is also the TPS that will affect it. So if the TPS is messed up, it is telling the computer an improper reading. A lot of times you're not going to have a steady RPM, so you'll have other symptoms there. But if your only symptoms are that you're just dumping raw fuel, it's usually something, one of the other things. Now, it could also be the computer. So the CDI box on that engine is what controls the injectors. So the CDI reads information from TPS and from the map and from the trigger and then from the O2 sensor. Now, if that CDI fails, it will tell the injectors to stay open longer than they should or whatever the case may be, and it will control the injectors and keep them open, which will dump that raw fuel into the cylinder and then right out the exhaust. So there's kind of like 100 different things that could be happening to have raw fuel coming out of the exhaust of the engine. So you're going to have to like do some serious troubleshooting. Like you're going to need to go through, and then, you know, OX66, the problem with those is you can't hook up a computer to get codes. You need to get a Winky Blinky, which is like this little light thing that plugs into the front. It will, you know, it blinks and gives you codes. So there is that, but, you know, that's going to kind of cover the gambit of what, you know, could be going on to be dumping that raw fuel out. It could be, you know, any number of those things. And it's just going to be a diagnostic thing of trying to cross each one of those things off and make sure everything's right. Again, if the trigger's messed up, like if it's not telling it to trigger and fire at the right time, but I don't know if the trigger really controls fuel injector sequences opposed to just the timing of the spark for your ignition coils. So not 100% on that one as far as an OX66 is concerned. I could be wrong on that one. That's the only one. I don't know about the trigger controlling injectors or if it just controls ignition coils. So there is that. Loebs wants to know the reason. Oh, Loebs is just telling us the reason the Avator, which is a Mercury Avator electric engine, we saw it down at the boat show. The reason the Avator lower prop shaft drive is so beefy is the actual electric motor which drives the outboard is located there. The top part of the engine is all battery and the computer plus tiller controls. So we were talking about how beefy the lower unit looks on the Avator. And then also there's other electric outboards out there that the bottom looks very beefy, and that is because the electric motor, the actual thing that is driving the propeller is down in the lower unit, and everything else up top is pretty much, you know, controls and a battery and that kind of stuff. So interesting, good comment, good to know. I mean, you look at some of these electric outboards that are coming out, they are getting a beefier lower unit when they're all in one. I did see Mercury has some of the bigger stuff. Mercury had what looked like an 115, but it was debadged and it was just all white, said Avator, and that one had a regular lower unit, all that stuff. And then there's also other ones that are like, you know, the Vision Marine and the Evo and the Acel is what, I'm not sure what it is, the EVDs, like, or EVDA. There's so many different companies, but a lot of those, same thing, they're using outboard lower units, and then the actual motor is up on top where you would normally have a power head. So that's kind of a difference there that I noticed is, you know, some of the smaller stuff, the motor's in the outboard in the lower unit. And then on the bigger stuff, the actual electric motor is on the top. Fishing Freak, how long will these poly tanks last if you use non-ethanol fuel? I have a 99 hull and was reluctant to use the tank that's under the deck because it's original. Using a portable tank now, but 6 gallons doesn't last too long. Would really like to use the 60-gallon tank instead. Honestly, a poly tank lasts for a really, really long time. Normally, the failure point of a poly tank is the fuel sender or the pickup. And then after, you know, so long, then a poly tank will crack. But that's a little bit less. It takes a long time for that to happen because usually the cracking comes from sun exposure and the plastic drying out, which the fuel will do that. But usually it's a pickup problem or a sending problem, and it leaks out of that. Honestly, you know, this is on a 1720 Key West. If you got the same boat, and I would be trying to use that tank. Like, I mean, 6 gallons, you know, like you said, you're not going to go very far. So I would definitely be trying to use the tank. If you're using a portable tank now, then your only risk is having to go back to the portable tank. But I would take that poly tank and look at the sender, see if that's leaking, pull the pickup and, you know, probably put a new pickup in it. Be very cautious. It does suck. Like if something breaks, if it does strip out and you have to pull it out on a Key West, usually it is, there's like a insert that's welded into the plastic on the bottom. It's like crimped in there. So a lot of times you can get the pickup out. There are some other brands that have poly tanks where that insert thing is not really as stable and it will spin. So that could be a problem, but getting that pickup out, if you mess it up pulling it out, then you can use JB Weld plastic weld, or you can get a plastic welder for cheap off Amazon and actually just, you know, plastic weld a new pickup in there. It will keep it from leaking, and you'll be able to use the tank. So as long as the physical tank itself does not have a problem, you can pressure test it, suck everything out of it, and then make sure, you know, you don't have a leak in your vent or your rig, you know, your fuel fill. And I'd be trying to use that tank, like fill it, you know, don't fill it all the way up the first time you get it going, but put 10 gallons in there. And after you've sucked everything up, you know, definitely make sure you got a water separator on the boat. So that way anything that's in that tank, because if you haven't been using it for a long time, it's probably got junk in there. And, you know, as you fill it up, it's going to wash the tank out and be pulling all that debris out of the tank. So make sure you got a water separator to catch all that debris. But 100%, I'd be trying to use that tank. I mean, 6 gallons. I mean, like you said, you're not going to go very far. So go for that. Chris Ramos, whenever I try and grease something, I pull the stupid fitting out and ruin the threads and it turns into a whole thing. I know it's my fault. Oh, we've all been there, Chris. We've all been there. It happens all the time. The grease fittings, that's what it is. Sometimes it's even better to just go ahead and pull the grease fitting out and try and clean it. If it's an older engine and it has not been greased in a long time, then go ahead and pull that thing out and like push the little ball thing to clean it out. And you could even soak it, you know, spray it in a little cup with Power Tune or something like that and soak it, free it up, and or Kroll, anything like that. And we've all been there. We've all been there where the grease fitting broke off or that Zerk fitting broke off. And yeah, it's a whole ordeal and it does suck. JP Gunderon, very interesting. I just put a riser bracket on the back of my 11-foot teeny. So the cavitation plate on my 5-horsepower outboard is level with the back of the boat. It flies when on plane with the weight distributed in the boat properly, but ventilates when you try to turn. Seeing this video where you say an obstruction can cause air bubbles has made me realize I didn't take into consideration the rib that runs down the center of the boat hull underneath. The plate is level with the flat of the hull, but higher than the rib down the center. I think when I turn, I'm getting air off of the rib that makes the motor ventilate. 100%. Like, 100%. This is talking about an engine. If you are losing RPM in your turn or you're getting prop slip, or you're overheating, all that stuff matters. So like it all plays into there. If you are getting air bubbles to the engine, like when it's trying to pick up water to cool the engine and you're getting air bubbles, like say a transducer or a through-haul fitting or, you know, a strake, anything like anything that's in it in front of the engine, whenever water comes across the bottom of the boat hull and it hits an obstruction, it creates air bubbles. And then those air bubbles go back. The engine sucks the air bubbles up. If it's on the prop and you're mounted too high, you will vent the propeller. So you will ventilate. I mean, you will slip. You're creating prop slip. So 100%, you got to get the mounting height correct. And then also, yeah, if you're turning and that rib is there and it's creating air bubbles, as you turn, you got to think about a boat. As it turns, it banks, you know, it rolls into a turn. So one side's going to air out and the other side's going to dig. So, I think you figured it out 100%. That's awesome. Something else to note is that I need to call somebody to see if it did fix this problem, but we have seen where twin engines, one will overheat based on the tow. So let's say you've got your two engines. They're supposed to be like straight with a little bit of tow in. So that way it'll help the boat track forward. Now, if the engines are towed too much or one is towed like too much and it's not straight, you can have where if you see how this is turned like this, it's supposed to be able to pick up water on this side and this side. But if you've got one engine that's turned like this, I've seen it where the water coming in like this, it is actually getting air on the back side of this and it's sucking air up into the cooling and it would actually overheat as you are cruising around at certain speeds. And all had to do with the tie bar between the two engines and making that engine crook like this to where it was sucking in air. Talking about ventilation, I mean, that's a whole nother topic right there. But Anthony, why does my grease gun keep getting stuck on the nipples? It's a 2003 200 horsepower VMAX Yamaha. That's back to the same thing with breaking off the Zerk fittings. It happens. So most grease guns, some are worse than other ones. There's like little teeth in there that like grab onto the fitting, and most of them you can spin the little tip. So probably the tip is just too tight. So put it on there. You might have a cheaper grease gun. Even some of the more expensive grease guns, it'll do that same thing sometimes. So you can just unscrew it, put it on there, tighten it up, pump it up, and then unscrew it again to get it to pull off. That's usually what's happening is the adjustment there where the teeth, it's going onto it and it's just gripping it. And, you know, you need to loosen it up to allow the teeth to pop up and release the fitting. So that's just all that's going on there. And we've all been there. So don't worry about it. Art Life. Geez, man, the technology is amazing, but there's always a but. We're sorry, boaters. Unless you want an under 200 horsepower Mercury, you'll need to mortgage your home to get one. And really, high voltage and water catering to millionaires seems to be their business model anymore. No wonder boats, brands like Daihatsu and Suzuki are really becoming the affordable, reasonable choice. That's kind of been the discussion for a few years now. That's why Suzuki has taken so much market share in the market, is that they are more affordable. Mercury and Yamaha and even the boats. I mean, everything is so expensive that, yeah, like, unless you got a lot of money, you ain't buying new stuff. I mean, this is probably a boat show comment talking about the different boats, the brands, and all the tech that's in the boats these days. Is they are packed full, and everything has gotten so expensive and heavily crammed into the boat that most of them, I think a lot of boat brands are actually trying to make their boats more like, you know, family sport type models, to where there used to be, it's like, this boat is a fishing boat. Like, that's what it is. You get on the boat, it's set up for fishing, you go fishing, you come back, that's it. Like, it's not, you know, in any sandbar boat. But nowadays, pretty much every single boat brand out there is trying to make a family-friendly type of boat and, you know, doing away with the strictly fishing type of boat. So, I mean, the market kind of dictates that too. So, You know, people spend money on stuff, and what people spend their money on, that's what dictates the market. And so brands are going to cater to whoever's spending money and what they're buying. And if that's what people spend their money on, then that's what they're going to make. So there is kind of that. But other than that, yeah, they definitely do cater to, it's a different world. I mean, it honestly is a different world these days. The days of go to college, get a 30, 40 year corporate job and stay there, those days are gone. I mean, there's so much money out there right now with social media and all these influencers and everything. Like it's the money that they're pouring in. If you go to the down in Miami or any of these other places and look at the sandbar, like there's money rolling. So who knows? Bill Jones, what is your favorite outboard? Well, that's going to depend, Bill, because I mean, I'll run anything. I like all the brands. I don't have one brand that I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't run that. Favorite engine to work on is going to be a Mercury Verado L6 because it's so easy. And making something super easy is obviously something that I care about because I'm the one that has to work on it. So there's that. But at the same time, huge fan of the Yamaha 4.2 and the F-150. If I had to pick a favorite, probably going to be the L6 Verado. So that's probably going to be my favorite. Gary, the biggest thing is the weight. A lot of people have to carry a motor sometimes. So we're talking about 2 strokes and 4 strokes. And yeah, that's a big deal, Gary. Like if you have to carry your motor, like, you know, let's say it's on a tender or, you know, you've got a little gnu or a canoe or a little John boat or something like that. And you got to carry this engine like 100%, like going from a 40 pound 2-stroke to a 80, 90 pound 4-stroke. That's a big deal. Like when you got to carry this motor from, you know, the house down to the dock and then put it on the boat or put it in your car when you get in the ramp, because there's a lot of people out there that have little John boats and stuff like that, or little canoes and stuff. They put them on top of the car, or inflatables and stuff, or even tenders. Like if you live on a sailboat or you have a dinghy, like say you've got a, you know, cabin cruiser, like a Silverton or something like that, and you've got a dinghy on it, so you take your boat out to an island or whatever, or some place, some river, and then you want to get in the dinghy and run around. Well, some of these places, you have to take the engine off of the dinghy and they, you know, based on the way they store it and tow it. So, yeah, that's a definitely a big talking point for a lot of people. I don't think we're going to get into the 2-stroke discussions today. We'll talk about that next week because that is a hot topic. I mean, there are so many people out there still running 2-strokes and you do not want to mess with the 2-stroke mafia. So, we're not going to get into that discussion today, but that's a good, very good point though, Gary. I mean, that's a very good point because yeah, if you got to carry the engine, I mean, another 40, 50 pounds is a big deal. This is your captain speaking. Amazing. Even though Lake Tahoe Patrol chose the E-Tech over 4-strokes because they're cleaner. Talking about 2-strokes and 4-strokes. Again, I mean, I'm trying not to get into this discussion today on this episode. I want to wait till next week, but, that's interesting. They did that in the Keys too. The FWC or Coast Guard, I can't remember, but they did that. They went over to the E-Techs. They bought like eight or nine of them or something like that, quite a bit. And they didn't even make it like a year. They blew up like 2 or 3 of them and then they took them all off the boats and scrapped them. So that is funny that the Lake Tahoe Patrol, a place where they probably are getting, you know, going to ban 2-strokes eventually, that they would pick the old Evinrudes over those. And then Richie says, I'm building a Chriscraft 213cc right now, getting a new floor, then rigging a 200 Merc. Just going to be an old fishing boat, but I love the lines. Me too, dude. I love a Chriscraft. Chriscraft is a very, very pretty boat. I mean, the lines and everything. Yeah, it's super classic, super classy. It's almost like, you know, that it's like a timeless type of look. Like it just looks clean, you know, all the time. There's like most of them, by and large, most of the Chriscrafts are like, you look at that boat and you're like, oh, wow, that is a good looking boat. And then at the same time, If you've ever looked at a brand new Chriscraft, wow, they are pricey. I mean, like, by and large, you're spending $300,000-$400,000 to start with. Like, that's to start with. You ain't even got no engines on the boat yet. You're going to get the boat. So, like, most of their boats are, you know, in the high 20s, 30s, and you're looking in the $500,000, $600,000, $1 million boat. Like, they are pricey, but I give it to them. It's a beautiful boat, but I just couldn't spend that amount of money on a boat. So, yeah, to buy an old Chriscraft and then fix it up and restore it, like, 100%, I would do that all day. They're very pretty boat. I mean, very, very pretty boat. Terry says, what do you think about the 2003 200 horsepower HPDI engine? I think it's a phenomenal engine. I mean, that V6 200 HPDI is the 150-200 is solid engine. I mean, I know a lot of people still running that engine. Clean fuel and maintenance. As long as you do those two things, like, they'll run really, really good. If you get poor fuel, though, and you start getting trash in your fuel system and you start having, you know, running problems because you're running bad fuel or a lot of ethanol through them, they don't like that. So that's no good. And then also, if you neglect them for too long, you know, most of them are 20 years old by this point in time. So it is definitely, they need to be oiled and greased and cleaned and, like, you know, CRC'd, protected. But as long as you take care of them, solid, super reliable. I got no complaints on a 200 HPDI. And even if you get one that's older, like, you clean it up and go through everything, usually you can make them last. Now, the bigger ones, they're a little bit more finicky. So, you know, we'll just leave it at that. Bassmeister, maneuverability during docking with twins is a big plus. Talking about two separate, you know, having one engine for two engines. And, twins, the maneuverability that you get with two engines is, it's a game changer. I mean, you can literally turn the whole boat on a dime. You can get into a slip. It really, really helps when you are in a really tight marina. And, you know, that's a big problem with a lot of people when you go out on the water. A lot of people get intimidated by going into really tight marinas or places where it's like, you know, there's a lot of boats around you or there's a lot of people watching. Having two engines gives you way more control because you can back up and do, you know, a lot more maneuverability with those two engines than you are with a single engine where you're whipping it back and forth and trying to, use the wind and the current and, like, float over here and then push over there. And you got the pole of faith out and, like, you know, it could become an entire spectacle, especially on really tight marinas where you got other boats sticking out at you and, like, you got to turn around or get to the end or, like, you know, weave through this whole spot. So definitely big, big, big difference to have two engines. Lil Dina, I was in Alaska and it's like Honda world out there. I couldn't believe how many big following. The Northwest is Honda land for sure. I think that's the only place Honda has a footing in the marine industry is in the Northwest. Washington, Alaska, that whole area up in there in Canada. I know a couple of dealers and some technicians that work up in that area. And that's definitely tons of people running Hondas. It's amazing how well a Honda does in cold salt water. But then you take that Honda and you put it down here in Florida in the hot salt water, it just doesn't hold up the same. So, you know, hopefully that'll eventually change and we'll see them, you know, come a little bit farther along. We've actually talked about this, I think, last week that Honda was, you know, coming out. They're building a boat with Scout. They've got a new BF350. Even though the thing is massive, they're putting effort into it, and we'll see exactly how far it goes and where, you know, it all ends. I think it's a good step for the industry. There's more of them. You know, the more builders and more manufacturers, the better, the more choices that we have. But, yeah, the Northwest, 100% Honda land all day. Christopher Williams, address I can send the triple guard grease to, 100%, send it to Aaron Hilligard.